welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. How was the camel, kid?
What? Sean, what are you saying? Wales?
Yeah, I'm in Wales, yeah. This is the second time we've recorded this. The first time I forgot to press record. But yeah. That tells you what I've been through, a six-hour drive, more than that, behind some interesting driving. Yeah, from Devon to Wales. I nearly got killed at Shropshire. Some lady stopped halfway around a roundabout, anyway, in the back of her.
Hashtag Uber,
yeah. She was driving nicely, so that was good. That was exciting. But I'm here. I'm looking out my window. I can see the water, Holyhead. I can see. I think it's Anglesey. I don't really know my geography.
No. We want an accent on that.
I could do southwest. I can talk about all that sort of stuff down there, but nothing else, because otherwise I'm going to offend somebody. So, yeah, I'll stick with the West Country accent. But I'm going to, if I have any Welsh listeners, I'm going to get complaints if I start talking.
We don't want to have unsubscribing.
yeah. Don't be offended. We're trying to be nice. We like our Welsh listeners. So yeah, don't leave us. Yeah, behave. But how you been? You all right?
Crazy, just working. Obviously, the usual madness. Yeah. I went for a run before I went to work. Obviously, showered, and then I was in a rush, so I didn't get to have a drink. And when I got to work, I was thinking, okay, I've got to take the bus from Camberwell to Russell Square, run it light. So I didn't jog there. I'd be out of service. Yeah. And I was thinking, okay, I'll go to the sweet shop. And the sweet shop, it was almost near the stop where I'm starting.
Yeah.
So I was like, I can't be bothered to take all my bags and run into Sainsbury's. Yeah. So I just closed the door behind, like the cab door.
Yeah.
And then obviously closed the door, went and got my drink, come back out. And there's people, so I parked at our bus stop near Sainsbury's. So when I'm coming back out with my drink, my little shopping bag, and then going to the bus, people give me funny looks because they're waiting for the bus.
Yeah.
And obviously this bus is out of service and I'm there with my little carry bag and drink. And to get to the main door, you just press the button on the outside, it opens and lets you on the bus. But to get into the cab where the driver sits, you need a little budget key.
Yeah.
So I had one, but it didn't fit. So I didn't check, right? And I'm like, crap. So I was thinking, oh man, I'm in a bad way because I couldn't. If I ring them up, like the carriage, and say, I'm locked out of my cab, can you send an engineer to give me a key? They're going to go, how could you be locked out of your cab halfway through the trip when you're supposed to be in the seat? So I was like, what can I do? And then I must have left the window open on the, obviously the driver's window open. Yeah. So I had to go around the outside of the bus. But the driver's window is, I kid you not, like neck height. And it's tiny. And I was thinking, you know what I'm going to have to do? I'm going to have to climb through the window. So there's all these people at the bus stop. And there's me climbing through head first. And you know when you climb through head first, you squiggle through like a worm?
Yeah.
So I'm wiggling in with my legs hanging out of the bus. All these people at the bus stop thinking, what's this guy trying to rob a bus? And then when I'm sort of in, because it's so small inside, obviously, for sitting, my head's going down by underneath the steering wheel with the pedals so I can get the rest of my body in.
I wish someone had taken a photo of this.
And then, obviously, once I've rolled about and adjusted this, so I sat up, brushed my shoulders off, started the engine, and I just drove off. I was like, okay.
Did you let everyone on?
Luckily, they weren't for that bus because that wasn't my stop, but my stop was the next one. So I was like, lucky it wasn't at the same stop.
So if you ever see a little worm trying to get inside the window of a London bus, you know that worm is Jermaine.
Oh, boy.
Nice. Well, I never said why I'm in Wales, did I? I think I mentioned I'm in Wales, but I never said why I'm in. I'm running the British mountain running, short course mountain running trial for the World Championships over here in Mool Ilia. I'm going to offend my Welsh listeners, again, but it's a mountain in here in Wales. We're going to be running up and down it on Saturday evening for a chance to make the World Championship team. So I'm excited. I'm ready. I'm having a good week. You need top four, but annoyingly, they've also said this thing. You know, Brexit's exit at the moment. They said that if the team doesn't look competitive, they're not going to take a team.
But they'll take the top four regardless.
No, they won't. So they won't. They'll only take people they think are going to run well. So it's basically they're just it's because it's expensive, right? It's expensive to go to.
Surely top two get automatic qualification to do the individual.
No, not even that. So they're cutting costs big time, aren't they? So this is like a trip to Patagonia, because that's where their final is. They're saying no one's guaranteed. They'll take a team if the team looks competitive. So they might, they'll probably take individuals. They'll take, there's a couple of guys they'll definitely take.
So if you beat someone and they take that person, surely you should go.
Yeah. But at the moment, as you know, with British Athletics, I think.
Oh, so let me get my Box of Swan matches. Yeah. I'm gonna play my violin and tell you, Sean, it's not looking good already.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not looking good. But I think I'm feeling good because we got over. We've been back in England for a week, and then less than that. But we came up on Saturday, and I've been back at home with my parents, and they've been helping me with the baby and Molly. And Molly said, more sleep. I've got a little thing on that, which is going to get the violin out again. But it's been really nice. I've gone from being, Molly said, the last couple of days in Amsterdam, I looked grey. My whole skin looked grey. She said, as soon as I've got back, I started eating and everything's good. And I'm now looking a normal colour. So I'm feeling much better. I'm ready to go. When was it? I think I had a lovely run this weekend around the coast of Bridport, which is where I'm from. If you know the programme, what's it called? Broadchurch. Do you know that programme?
No.
Okay, it was on ITV a while back, but basically I live where that is. Well, I did live where that was, so I grew up there. So that was real nice, and I feel really good. But then on Monday or Tuesday, I went out for a run. And you know, like, it's the time of the year when there's loads of flies out?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So it was fine. I was running along about half an hour in, and I got this really big one in my eye, my right eye. So I started scratching, right?
You got big one in your eye.
A big fly. I scratched it so hard, it scratched my eyeball. Right. So my eye was hurting. My eye was watering. I was running down. My eyes to get the fly out. And then another fly landed in the same, I was going to swear then, the same eye. So I got home. My eye was, because I've got, you know, I'm a bit stupid. So I was just trying to get the fly out. And I basically scratched my eye. So the night after, the baby slept all the way through, but my eye was killing so bad. I didn't sleep. So whatever happens, whatever goes right, I managed to derail myself in some way. But I've since then, I'm back on. So the fly incident is put to the back. I'm ready to go. It's going to be a good race. Hey, we should complain about British Athletics, because one thing, since we've the last podcast, your mate Phil, is it Phil Norman?
Yeah, he did. Selected him because the minimum they invite, so for an event, if it's less than 30 people qualify, they give special invites because they want the numbers to be up to at least 30 so they can have the right numbers for heats and stuff.
Yeah.
So he missed the qualifying by less than half a second.
Yeah.
And he got an invite because he was the next fastest person in the world to go. And then UK Athletics said, no, we're not taking you.
That's an embarrassment, isn't it?
It's crooked.
Because the thing is, like, so what are they? What difference is it going to make? Because basically, the combination, right? I assume
it's already paid for and it's got loads of space. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no cost there.
And in the flight, sometimes they get charter flights, so it's just like a plane and they list seats. But we're not talking about an organisation that's poor. So you think, and if it was that, if it came down to it only is your flight, the athlete would say, "I'll pay for my own flight."
Yeah.
And if they would say no, I'd say I'll pay for my own flight and accommodation because they've given me the invite.
Yeah. What? And it's so crazy because it's hard. Like, you want to be encouraging hard-working athletes, right? And this guy worked all year.
It's also down to who your coach is and stuff. And obviously, because his coach is not a UK Athletics coach, they're not worried about picking them because they always want the UK Athletics coaches athletes to get selected.
Then it makes
their choice of picking those coaches as good choices. because those coaches, athletes, are going to the championships.
Yeah. And I tell you what, I bet you, you know that official or that team manager who entered the shot putter in the relay, I bet he's going along to that, or she's going along to that, to the World Championships. Do you know what I mean? So that they're not going to stop them going along, but an athlete goes ahead and works hard.
And they did the same to Rimmer and Learmonth in the indoor about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Where they got invited to go, and it was like Europeans, which is not even expensive to go to Europe, but they just said no.
Ah, God. It gets to a point, doesn't it, when I think, as a runner, should we pay our subscription fees? I know that's England Athletics, but do you know what I mean? Why are we paying our subscription fees?
Well, this is why I stopped playing when I was younger, trying to be a professional footballer. I went for running because I was thinking, at least with running, is if you run hard and you run fast, you get picked. You know, like, because you go on your own merit.
Yeah.
But football, you're always waiting for someone else to make the choices.
Yeah.
As the manager, where okay, he didn't get the qualifying time, but he still got invited by IAAF. So therefore, he done the hard work. He should be allowed to go.
Yeah, yeah. God, it's bad. But I shouldn't be too rude about him because I'm going to try and qualify on Saturday. So
they probably shaft you as well. So you better take that Vaseline.
Yeah. One man who does not need Vaseline though is Jeffrey Comoro. He's broke the world record at half marathon. Did you see? We talked about this a bit earlier, but he ran 58.01 in Copenhagen. Pretty amazing performance. I think he beat it by 17 seconds, the world record. He is amazing. And he is, like, actually, he links into our interview a bit today, but him and, you know, who's that guy? Who's the best 1500-meter runner male in the world? His name's Timothy Cheruiyot. So what I think Cheruiyot and Comoro, what they're both, what's similar about those two is they look really ungainly. Do you know what I mean? And they look that, like they're not like, Cheruiyot does not look like a good athlete. He doesn't look like he's running fast, but he's really rapid. And Comoro is the same. He's doing it for the men who look ugly. He's doing it for men like me. He's doing it for the ugly runners out there.
I appreciate that, but yeah.
So yeah, if you're an ugly runner, if you're not, your style's not nice, you can still do it. Look at Jeffrey Comoro, look at Timothy Cheruiyot. They're doing it, they're showing us how it's done. The Jermaines of this world, you know, they've got Eliud Kipchoge and
these guys
are beautiful runners. Yeah, we need ugly runners.
But we don't go anywhere.
Yeah. And talking about ugly runners, that brings us on to our interview. So today, I hope this goes out today, it's the 19th of September, is the birthday of one of the ugliest runners in the world, but one of the best. That's Emil Zátopek, who was around during the 50s. He is, I think he was voted the greatest runner of all time in 2013. So I think it's a runner's world poll or something, but he was an ugly runner. So I thought it'd be quite fun to have a few interviews where we talk about the legends of the games. So we're going to try and talk about Radcliffe and all those kind of guys, but Zátopek is one that... it doesn't get really talked about as much. And given it's his birthday, we thought it'd be interesting to interview the author of his biography, or one of his biographies, Richard Asquith. So people might know Richard Asquith. He wrote also a book about fell running, which is called Feet in the Clouds. Really good book. I recommend you check out his and the autobiography. And we're going to interview him now about Zátopek on his birthday. Here we go. On this week's show, we're talking to author Richard Asquith. How are you doing, Richard?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. And you're the author of three books that runners might know, which is I've got a couple of them myself in my stack of books. Which is the first one being Feet in the Clouds, a book about fell running.
Yeah.
And Running Free, is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And the one we kind of want to talk about the most. Is Today We Die a Little, which is about a biography of Emil Zátopek.
That's correct.
But I should first ask, because I'm getting into fell running myself. I should say I read your book a few years ago, and this is in 2013, 2014, and then I ran
based upon how much I enjoyed it. I ran the UK Intercounty Spell Running Championships, and I won back in 2014.
You won, just like that.
Yeah, it was. It was. I was quick at the time. I was running well at cross country, so it made sense to give it a go. But I've since been doing a bit. I'm trying at the moment to qualify for the mountain running team for Great Britain. So I'm running next weekend, or the weekend coming up. In Wales, which is more of a fell running race, apparently. In is it Mole Elio or something? I think is the venue we're running the mountain running up in Snowdon. So yeah, right. Just hopefully you're the inspiration. Hopefully
for the book. Don't blame me. Don't blame me.
Yeah. If it all goes wrong, I'm going to call you up. But we want to talk about Emil. So yeah. What made you write a biography about him? What inspired you to do that?
I guess it's always been my hero. I mean, you know, he's great days as a runner was the 1940s and 1950s, but you know, I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s, and you know, he was still, everyone had heard of him. He was the great runner, the greatest runner there'd ever been. I mean, even now, you know, as recently as 2013, I think Runner's World called him the greatest runner over any distance of all time. And he was a hero to me. It wasn't so much because of what he achieved, although, you know, he did get some, I think, sets of 18 world records, won 5 Olympic medals. He went unbeaten over 10,000 meters for 6 years. But it wasn't that. It was more the sort of, it was the way he ran. You know, he invented new forms of training. He changed ideas about what was physically possible. But he also sort of, he embodied the whole romance and adventure of running. I particularly associated him with the 1948 Olympics in London, which were the first Olympics after the Second World War. And yeah, that's when, you know, Emil himself said it was as if the sun had come out. And, you know, what he did there really captures the romance of that. And he was a man of relatively limited natural talent. But what he achieved was by sheer force of character, really. He made himself the greatest distance runner the world had ever seen.
Then
the final thing is that for me, growing up in the 60s and 70s, he was a liberal who then disappeared because of his opposition to communism. And that's sort of added to the romance. You know, it wasn't just inspiring, but there was a mystery to it as well. What happened to it? So I always felt that someone should write a story, and no one really did write the full story, and then a publisher suggested that I did, so I went for it.
Yeah, well, what's behind the title? Today we Die a Little. What's the story behind that?
Well, so one of the great things about him was that he was always saying, he was really clever, witty, friendly man. He said endless aphorism. He was always chatting to athletes of all nations and all different languages. Right at the end of his career, in 1956, Melbourne Olympics, he was, you know, he was way past his best. He was injured. He'd, you know, just recovered from an operation. He was so unfit. He'd been running up and down the aeroplane on the way to Australia until his fellow athletes held him down because they were afraid he was going to cause a crash. He had to run the marathon. It was only the second marathon of his life. He's injured, old. Unbelievable temperatures, getting up to about 35 degrees Celsius. And he was standing next to some Americans. He just turned and said, "Men, today we die a little." And in the West, that just sort of just went into running folklore. And it sort of slightly captures what endurance running is about. You know, you've got to, you know, if you're really going for it, you're putting yourself through something that's just starting to get onto the borderline of dying, and he understood that, but he was sort of cheerful about it, and I think that's what people love.
Yeah, and then obviously he's made a bit of a resurgence now. You've written a book about him. People are talking about him. I mean, I was born in the 80s, but I know about Zaterpec. Why do you think he strikes a chord for distance runners now?
Most modern training methods are slightly based on his training, what he introduced, and his sense of what the human body was capable of. And without that, you wouldn't have had modern distance running. Yeah. I think the other thing is a lot of his training and his approach was very much to do with, you know, it's less the physical side and the number of seconds it takes you to do a lap or the number of laps you do on that. It's more to do with the attitude. For him, it was all to do with training on the borders of pain and suffering, as he used to call it. You know, it was like training yourself to disregard physical discomfort. And I mean, yeah, if you look at the absolute cutting edge of modern training techniques, one of the great mysteries of endurance running is the idea that, you know, the brain quits before the muscles do, which is just a sort of fact. You know, what made him unique was he sort of showed the way how to, through what you do through your character, your approach to life, the way you look at things, your approach to physical discomfort, you can change the sort of runner you are, and you can become a better version of yourself. I think, you know, people, to me, I'm just a, unlike you, I'm just a rubbish runner. I'm middle of the road, middle of the field runner, that's what it is. But, you know, even for me, running is a way of finding my better self. And I think for, you know, people of all kinds of running spectrum, that tends to be the case. And Emma was a great example of how to do that.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, actually. I was just thinking then about sort of sports in general and sports fans, because if you look at, this is completely different, but you look at Ronaldo versus Messi. So Messi is the one that seems to be blessed with unbelievable natural talent. And Ronaldo seems to be the guy that is able to push himself and manipulate himself and become an incredible talent. And I guess the same with Federer and maybe Nadal. Federer is the natural talented one and Nadal isn't. In those sports, it tends to be the technical, the gifted guy that everybody loves.
That's the guy you favour, isn't it?
Yeah, but not in running. I don't think that's the case. I think Farah is an incredible athlete and he's blessed and he's a beautiful runner to watch and stuff. But I think people have more, I don't know, respect for Zatopek because he just seems like a guy that really tries. I guess you've got more an affinity with him, but it's funny that difference between the sports, how we tend to, to put that at the top of the pedestal, really.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I mean, with Zatopek, that's certainly true. There was a French writer, Pierre Magnon, who called him a man who ran like us. Yeah. And one of the things about Zatopek, he had the most terrible visual style.
Yeah.
If you looked at him, people used to joke about how he looked like a, you know, man who'd been just stabbed in the heart, a man having a fit, or a man wrestling with an octopus on a conveyor belt. And he just sort of, he always grimaced and he was sort of clawing the air with his hands. And he didn't look like a graceful runner.
Yeah.
But you could feel the effort he was making. I think people really responded to that.
Yeah.
And and his greatest race of all, which was the 5,000 metres final in the 1952 Olympics, he was up against, you know, a whole load of much more talented runners than him, faster, more beautiful, more, you know, just more talented runners. But he won through sheer, you know, what he had inside, what he had in his heart.
Yeah, yeah. Is that the famous image of him? Is it Alain Mamoon, the French guy behind him struggling, and there's a British guy, might have been Chataway?
That's right. Chris Chataway. So there was, you know, with half a lap to go, you had, I think Chataway was leading, and then Herbert Chardin, and then Alain Mamoon, and yeah, he'd beaten Gaston Reiff. All these people were better than him. Emil was coming fourth, a bad fourth, with half of that to go. And then suddenly, just by sheer willpower, you see him, this grimacing, clawing figure, just forcing his way past these people. You know, Chris Chataway basically falls over with exhaustion, and he goes along and wins. It's fantastic. It's the most exciting final 200 metres in all schools, I think.
So let's talk about his life then. Back in the early days, as a child, was there any inclination there that he would be a great athlete? Did you find much about his childhood from your research?
I mean, I found quite a lot about his childhood, but I think, you know, he came from a very, very poor background in a little town called Kropivnica in Moravia, in the sort of depths of Czechoslovakia. You know, sport wasn't really an option. You know, him and his brothers weren't allowed to play football and that, because they only had one pair of shoes and they shouldn't damage them in any way. They should be working to keep the family alive. I've met various old school friends of his, and yeah, everyone talked about how active and energetic he was. But school, no. And there's just a lot of hardship in his life. I mean, by the time he was 18, you know, two of his brothers were dead. Another brother had probably by then been taken off by the Nazis to be a slave labourer. Emil himself was working in a sort of factory come sweatshop where they made shoes in southern Moravia, you know, a bit like one of these sort of sweatshops where they make iPhones and things like that today. And he first raced in 1941 when he was 18, basically because he was made to. He was in this sort of residential factory come school thing, and the director said, "You've got to race because we have this annual race in honor of our founder." And he didn't want to, and he was told he'd got to. And eventually he was dragged to the starting line. And only then, I mean, he came second to that race, never really having raced before, and realised he had a natural talent. And then gradually got persuaded to try a bit more, and suddenly got into it then. But until then, he'd had no running background, no real sporting anything.
Right. And so how did he progress? And how so he started then taking it a bit seriously. Did he sort of join a club? Did he start running fairly quickly internationally? What was the progress?
Okay, so basically, this is 1941. So remember, Czechoslovakia is under Nazi occupation.
Hmm.
He's living in this sort of factory type educational establishment, which has been taken over by the Nazis as well. So they're meant to be producing shoes and stuff for the Nazi war effort.
Hmm.
Being a runner is one chance to escape. So that's one of the things that attracted to him. You go into it, you could go out on the running track, and while you were training, you were free, basically. You could do what you wanted. He found himself getting better at it. He found that, I think, in fact, the first time he won a race, which took him a couple of years before he even won a race, someone gave him some food, an apple. And I think it was an apple. And, getting extra food in those days was a major plus. It was a pretty tough time. And so he started thinking about how he could be better, what he could do to win more. He was very clever. He wasn't very educated, but he was a very thoughtful, intellectual man, amazing memory. And he used to experiment, and he used to do things. So one very characteristic example, when he was living in this place, in Zlín, he began to see how long he could hold his breath for. And he initially thought, well, I'm going to go from one tree to the next, holding my breath. And he thought, I'll do two trees, and then three trees, and so on and so on. And he eventually did this until he actually passed out. So he had this sort of crazed experimental approach to running. And all through his life, he was doing these weird things. After the war, he joined the army, and because it was under communism, he got to become an army officer, and he went to officer training college. And he would, he'd train in the sand where the horses used to ride, because it was harder if you ran in the sand. And he would train in his army boots, because that made it harder, and it also meant he could then go in the woods and not sprain his ankle. Or if he was on sentry duty, he'd just run on the spot while he was on sentry duty, because he didn't like to waste it. He just felt, the more he trained, the better he would get.
Yeah.
And he was probably a little bit crazy about that, but because he was doing it in this backwater, totally cut off from the mainstream of, Western training philosophy, he really didn't know what was normal. So he just did what seemed sensible to him.
Wow. And so when did he start making his breakthrough? And when did he start being able to represent the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia as it was then? When did he start? Did he make that break?
I think basically, after the war, he started running for Czechoslovakia and doing some international races. His big breakthrough was the 1948 London Olympics. They go abroad. Czechoslovakia has been taken over by the communists 4 months earlier. World on its knees after the war, but London puts on these austerity Olympics. It's all very basic. Zaspek runs in the 10,000 meters, and he not only wins it, he wins it so spectacularly. He sort of laps virtually everyone. The judges have basically become confused. He's so far ahead. At one point, he sort of stops and throw down and pats another runner on the back to encourage him. I think they only recorded the first 11 finishing positions, and two of those were wrong. It was the most spectacular 10,000 meter race anyone had ever seen. I couldn't believe that someone could run this fast while having this weird style.
Yeah.
And there are a few Czechoslovaks in the crowd, and they're all shouting, Zaspek, Zaspek. And somehow the London crowd took him to their heart. It was sort of very nice the way that the Zaspek and London fell in love together. And then a few days later, they have the 5,000 meters. And I mean, cutting a long story short, it's a horrible rainy day and he completely blows it. He sort of loses concentration. And getting into the last lap, he's 60 meters behind, coming third. And then suddenly he wakes up and decides he's going to try and catch up. And he does the most amazing final lap, where he overhauls the second person, and he virtually overhauls the Gaston Reif, who's leading. And everyone in the stadium, apart from Reif himself, can see what's happening. And so the excitement he has this little figure in red running in this weird style, gradually sprints the whole way. The stadium just go crazed with excitement, and Reif can't work out what he's shouting about. First, he thinks they're shouting about him. And he wins by Rife went by a stride, so you know, that's a real disappointment for Emil Zatopek. But at the same time, that's what really won the heart of London. And it's interesting that when I started researching Today We Die Little, I talked to quite a lot of younger runners and said, I might have a book about Emil Zatopek. And I said, who? Never heard of it. And yeah, I could talk to older people, people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, even people with no interest in sport at all. And they say, oh, Zatopek. Oh, yes, I remember him. London Olympics, Emil Zatopek. You know, he just...
Really?
It was like sort of, you know, Usain Bolt or something like that. It a cheap crossover from sport. So that's when he became a celebrity.
Yeah.
And, of course, back in communist Czechoslovakia, he was even bigger celebrity because they really need, for them, having a gold medalist, their first ever gold medalist for Czechoslovakia in a running event, was a, you know, huge boost. So they took him to their heart. He became the poster boy for communist Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, wow. And much has been made of his training. You're talking about sort of inventing also the modern approach to today were largely, or he had a hand in a lot of those. Did his training then change when he started to become the big star and started to almost leave the cloud of communist Czechoslovakia and start to become more of an international runner? Did he then change his training and start to develop these new approaches?
No, I think basically when he started off training, there was this, you know, if you're a distance runner, the idea was you just ran lots of laps slowly, and the longer the distance, the more that you ran, and that was all there was to it. He sort of had this idea that if you want to run fast, then you need to practice running fast rather than practicing running slowly. Mm. And so he began to develop this idea of running intervals and doing, you know, fast sprints and then slow recovery things and so on. Other people were sort of exploring this a bit, but he developed it more. I think the thing that as he became famous, what he then did, he just upped the volume. That was what was really unique about him.
Yeah.
And it's hard to convey now how weird this seemed at the time, but by the time you get through to the early 1950s and you've got people like Chris Chataway and Roger Bannister, etc., yeah, their idea of training was you mustn't do too much. And if you do too much, you know, the body can't stand it. You've got to run a bit and then rest a bit, etc.
Mm.
And when they went to the Helsinki Olympics in 1952, people were just gobsmacked by what Zatopek was doing. You know, rumours went about, was he really doing these, you know, scores and scores of repetition of 400-metre repetitions every day.
Mm.
And people sort of didn't believe it. Just seemed mad. They thought his body couldn't possibly take it. But
what
then
was the
because
most
he got
tear, what was the you know the what sort of things they say? How many times? How many repetitions? What was the wildest guess that he of the number of reps he was doing?
I think the wildest guess he's never got. I mean, he actually there was a time in 1954, according to his training diary, the thing he wrote about his running. He was doing 400-meter repetitions a day.
Whoa.
Which was actually, you know, it was crazy. I mean, it was too much. I think he probably would have been a better runner at that stage if he had a bit less quantity and a bit less quality. So, I mean, obviously, if you're doing that many, you do start slowing down a bit.
Yeah. Wow. And so basically then nobody was doing the same thing. He was out on his own sort of running that sort of mileage and that sort of intensity.
Well, yes, but he, you know, one of the things about Emil was he was, and one of the things I love about him, one of the reasons I wanted to write about him was he was really friendly, open person. He was no just doing it for himself. For him, running was, you know, it was more a vehicle for friendship than a vehicle for personal glory. Mm. And so whenever he raced against people, he would talk to the people he was racing against. Mm. He eventually taught himself to be fluent in 8 languages and spoke various other languages badly.
Mm.
Some runners were driven mad, by the way. He'd chat away to them in mid-race. But he became really good friends with most of his good rivals. And so people like Alain Mumoun, the Frenchman, became good friends with him and learned from him.
Mm.
And again, you know, Gaston Rive, Herbert Chardin, Chris Chataway, less so. But, you know, they would talk to him. They would say, what do you do? And he'd say, well, this is what I do. And, you know, if they wanted to learn from him, they would. He didn't keep secret. So gradually, the best runners of his time began to imitate him and catch up with him,
mm.
which is one of the reasons why, you know, by about 1954, 1955, he was really struggling. You know, it's becoming harder for him,
yeah.
Because he was no longer so far ahead of other people.
Yeah. And I've seen mentions of other innovations in his training. And his, what kind of thing did you find out about his diet and that sort of thing? Did he have any kind of interesting approaches to that? Did he think about
I mean, he tried all sorts of things. He'd do it, you know, I think at one point he tried eating loads of garlic. Another time, according to one friend, he started eating the leaves of beech trees because he said, you know, deer run fast and they eat beech leaves. So I'm going to try it. He was a great believer in beer.
Yeah.
His first world record, he ran after drinking a beer. And he used to say, this gives me strength. And when he went out to the Melbourne Olympics, he actually took a whole crate of Pilsner Urquell specialty with him. So, yeah, that's worth knowing. But he used to try. Otherwise, I think he just used to eat when he was hungry and drink when he was thirsty. That's what he said.
Yeah. Okay.
But what he would never do was miss an opportunity to train. So, you know, if he had to run in the snow, he'd run in the snow.
Hmm.
If he wasn't allowed outside, he'd train inside. There was one time where he famously trained in the bath. He had to do the washing, so he just put all the washing in the bath and just ran on the spot for a couple of hours, kneading with his bare feet, causing great flood. And there was also a time before the 1950 European Championships where he got terrible food poisoning about a couple of weeks before, or less, about 10 days before.
Mm.
He was put in a hospital. He got his stomach pumped, everything. It looked like he couldn't possibly go to the games. But he was determined not to. So he sort of, you know, waited until the doctors weren't looking, snuck out of bed, you know, ran around the hospital gardens a bit, so he wouldn't miss some training. He sort of managed to check himself out just in time to catch the plane and fly to Brussels and win two gold medals. You know, so it was a bit crazy, like that.
I read somewhere, there was a couple who wrote it, but it was they use that as an example of how rest is important.
Which is really possibly, yes, because he did that on that occasion. He did, I mean, obviously, he had done a bit less then, and he did do spectacularly well immediately afterwards. So maybe that was a question, and it was of rest being important. And it, you know, it is actually interesting to speculate how much better he might have been had he at times trained a bit less.
Yeah, but he famously, what we should probably talk about. Kind of his maybe I don't know if you agree, but maybe the highlight of his career being the 52 Olympics.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, the 52 Olympics, all the strands of his life came together really. So, first of all, I'm just a spoiler alert. Yeah, he won the 10,000 meters and the 5,000 meters and the marathon. Wow. He's the only person ever to do that, and no one else ever will.
No,
because, you know, the events are far too specialized. No, it just ain't going to happen. Yeah. He won the 10,000 meters really easily, even more easily than in London. Well, no, that Alan Moon was with him a bit more then, but, you know, fantastically well. 5,000 meters, I've mentioned already, you know, really, really tough race, toughest race in his career. He just wins it by sheer willpower.
Mm.
And then, partly because of the pressure he's under from the communists, he needed to win at least two golds. He was scared that he was going to lose 5,000 meters. So just as insurance, he thought he'd enter the marathon as well, even though he'd never run a marathon before.
Hmm.
So having won these two distance events, he then runs his first ever marathon, has no idea what he's doing. So he sort of tags on to Jim Peters, the British world record holder, chats away to him a bit, you know, irritates the hell out of him. After about 10 miles or so, he sort of says, I was going to wonder, you know, Jim, the pace is this pace a bit right? It feels a bit fast to me. And Peter's trying to psych him out. So Peter says, no, it's too slow. So Emil says, so okay then, and accelerates. And you know, shortly afterwards, Peter gives up. And so Emil, in the first marathon, sets a new Olympic record, wins by several minutes, drags, I think, first five or six runners. Also under the Olympic records, he's dragging through so fast. But the great thing about it also is that 1952 Olympics, you know, the Cold War Olympics, is the first time the Soviet Union had taken part.
Mm.
They insist on having two athletes' villages. So there's a Western one and there's a communist one with barbed wire and armed guards.
Wow.
Czech athletes are under huge pressure not to fraternize with Westerners. But Emil has become this sort of catalyst of his focal point for friendship between the two nations. And first of all, the the Australian runner, there's Perry goes around to see him, and Emma invites him in and says, "You come to see me, you honour me, you must train with me," and then he makes him eat with him. And then Percy Serity, the Australian trainer, comes around, Emma invites him and shares all the secrets with him. Percy Serity stays so late that, you know, he can't get out because they've locked the gate. So Emil gives up his bed to him. This is just and sleeps in the woods and stuff. And this is just a couple of nights before 10,000 meters. But he had this obsession with friendship.
Yeah.
And then come the marathon, everyone in the stadium, everyone in the world virtually wants Emil to win. Mm. He's just sort of caught everyone's imagination so much. So this, you know, the final lap, he comes in and the entire stadium, very few of him are Czechoslovaks, are just chanting Zlatopek, because he's, for him, he's embodying, you know, the shared humanity of sport. And so there's that glorious aspect of it as well.
Yeah.
And the one other thing about this highlight of Emil's career is that it very nearly didn't happen at all. Mm. Because just as the Czechs were about to leave Prague and go to Helsinki, Emil discovers that a friend of his, Stanislav Jungwirth, has been chucked out of the team because his father has committed some political offence and they thought he's a security risk and he doesn't get allowed to go. And so Emil says, right, well, if he's not put in back for the team, I'm not going.
Wow.
Which is like a suicidal thing to say in that climate. In communist Czechoslovakia, there were, you know, people were being executed for political offences. So, you know, up to 100,000 people were put in concentration camps for political offences. You couldn't do something, that sort of thing, but Emil did. And he had this standoff that seems to have lasted several days where the plane flies off without him. And the communist officials are trying to explain why, you know, their star athlete isn't actually at the games.
Yeah,
and eventually, I think they're so scared of getting in trouble, they just cave in, and he goes out and Jungwirth goes out as well. But, you know, that tells you something about the extraordinary character that Emil had as well.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but I was going to say, what do you think about his personality that stood out? But I think kind of you summarised it there. You said that he epitomised the spirit of running and the camaraderie, I guess.
Yeah, no, he was just a very, very generous spirited man, I think. And sorry, just one other thing. Can I just throw in one other thing about Magic Fiction
Olympics? Yeah.
One of the other things I loved about Emil Zlatopek's story is the love story of his life. So Dana Zlatopkova, as she's now called, was a javelin thrower. Mm. She was born on exactly the same day as Emil, the same day of the same year.
Yeah.
We could get married on the same day, he said to her. So they did. So they got married. at the London Olympics, they were both there. They were engaged. Well, they got engaged there. And there was this time when Dana was over in the women's quarters somewhere in Northwood, I think, and Emil was in the men's quarters somewhere else. And he sort of sneaked across London by public transport at dawn to show her one of his medals. And they sat by the swimming pool. So he showed her his medal and she dropped it in the swimming pool and he had to dive in and get it. And then he had to take his clothes off and he was chucked out of the girls' dormitory for being nude. It was this ridiculous story. But in 1952, they're married by then. Dana is there as well. He wins his second gold medal in 5,000 metres an hour or so before the javelin final.
Mm.
So Dana meets him, grabs his gold medal for him, says, "Give it to me for luck," stuffs it in the bag, goes off, and then she wins a gold medal as well.
Wow.
So they also won a gold medal on the same day as one another. And they're a really great couple, really friendly, always telling jokes. And Pete, lots of Western athletes became friends with them, and, you know, people like Gordon Perry often used to go and visit them, and so that's part of the story as well, really.
Yeah, fantastic. And it didn't really, his career then from that point didn't really last much longer. He was around for a couple more years, but things started to tail off, would you say, around sort of the mid to late 50s?
Yes, I think, well, I mean, 1954, I think, was his last world record. There was a problem that, you know, other runners were catching up with him. They were just, you know, using his methods, and new people like Vladimir Kutz came along using his variations of his methods. Emil just used to up his workload more and more and more. And he was, you know, so what was he then? He was getting to, by 1956, he was 34. He had a hernia operation in that summer. Mm. Yeah, he was still pretty formidable athlete, pretty hard the beat, but he wasn't getting it past it. Basically, there wasn't much more he could do. In the Melbourne Olympics, he had that marathon. Where he said, "Today we die a little," and then he came sixth. It's actually well worth watching if you can see on YouTube the end of that race, because what's amazing is that Emil really, really struggled that day. I mean, he really did nearly die that day. He hobbles in sixth place. Alain Mimoun, the Frenchman, who's won so many silver medals behind Emil over the previous decade, wins. He finally wins his own Olympic medal. And rather than going to celebrate, he just waits. He's waiting for Emil to finish. You can see finisher after finisher coming. And eventually Emil sort of staggers in. The whole stadium rises to him because he's the great hero that everyone loves. He gets to the line and virtually collapses in this terrible heat. And then he comes over to him and says, Emil, I won a medal. And so Emil sort of staggers to his feet, puts his cap back on. And he's a soldier, remember? So he salutes. And then he embraces Mimoun. It's the most lovely moment of, for Emil, always running in sport about friendship.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Is there a story, I can't remember who it was, but was there a story about, I think it was an Australian athlete maybe, who visited Emil?
Yeah, absolutely. Ron Clark. I've forgotten about that. So Ron Clark was just a wonderful runner in the 1960s. He eventually erased most of Emil Zatopek's records. He was just unbeatable, except he had this real bad luck. He did have this thing about big tournaments, and he always blew it in the Olympics, the Commonwealth Games, whatever it was. He just somehow couldn't win that gold medal. Emil really admired him because he could see what beautiful style he had. He loved the way he ran from the front and just went for it. And so in 1966, he invites him. He's sort of involved with the Czech Athletic Federation. He sends Clark an invitation to come and compete at an athletics meeting in Prague. So Clark agrees because he said to me, I wasn't going to miss an opportunity to meet Emil Zatopek. This is one of them days when East and West just didn't meet. So it's a great opportunity for him. So he goes to visit Emil. Emil is just the most amazing host to him. They go and train together in the woods where Emil used to train. Emil takes him shopping. They eat together. He takes him to his flat. And, they just really bond and become good friends. And they talk about, that Emil's training methods and Ron Clark's training methods. They talk about the upcoming Olympics, which is the 1968 Olympics in Mexico, which were obviously going to be a huge problem for Clark because they were a great altitude, and back then it pretty much meant that Clark didn't have a hope then. And then the end of the visit comes. Emil escorts him to the airport because Emil's such a celebrity, he's sort of able to go through customs with him, take him all the way up to the airplane steps. And then as they're saying goodbye, they shake hands, and Clark feels that Emil has pressed some small package into his hand. So he thinks, oh my God, he's asking me to smuggle something out. So he just sort of closes his hand, puts it in his pocket, and goes onto the plane and just doesn't do anything. He thinks maybe I'll look at it when I get home. So they fly back. He's going by London. They land in London. Eventually, before they get off the plane, curiosity overcomes him. I think in one version of the story, he goes to the toilets to have a look at it. He unwraps his package, and it's one of Emil's gold medals from Helsinki, the Olympic gold medal. And the note with it says something like, not out of friendship, but because you deserve it.
Wow.
And there's a little inscribed box saying, to Ron Clark from Emil Zatopek. And back then, no one was ever going to hear about this. This wasn't in the years of the age of social media. This was, it was an entirely private gesture from one human being to another.
Yeah.
Emil hadn't told anything about it. I mean, Dana, his wife, didn't hear about it until years later. He was in major trouble with her when she heard about it. But, it's an act of extraordinary generosity. And then Clark was so moved, he said, just sat in that toilet and wept. Because that's, for me, what makes him a hero.
Yeah, incredible. And it, with the, after his career finished, how did things change? Obviously, he was then living in Czechoslovakia. And you mentioned he was a liberal. And how did things change for him? Did he
sort of
public recognition?
Well, so basically, all that time, he's after the 1952 Olympics, you know, it's just glory, glory, glory. But he's constantly having to make public appearances. Everyone watches him. He's fantastically good with people. And, you know, no one's too unimportant for him to say a friendly word to them or give them an autograph or whatever. Basically, Czechoslovakia in the 1950s was a very nasty totalitarian regime. Gradually, in the early 1960s, it begins to people begin to see it's not working and there's a liberal movement begins. By the key moment comes in 1968 when Alexander Dubček takes over the Communist Party. The liberal reformers basically are now in charge. Dubček introduces this program called Socialism of a Human Face. Mm. They, you know, they stop censorship, they rehabilitate political prisoners, they, you know, introduce elements of free market economy. People are allowed to travel again. Everyone who remembers it, who I spoke to, seemed to think of it as a glorious time to be alive. You know, you still had the basic equalities of communism, but, you know, suddenly there was optimism and hope.
Mm.
But meanwhile, and Emil was a really enthusiastic supporter of this, and he and Dana were friends of Alexander Dubček and used to, you know, appear at places. The Soviet Union was absolutely horrified to see all this happening and thought, you know, this was threatening the foundations of socialism. They kept, you know, trying to put pressure on Dubček to stop it. But eventually, in August 1968, they say, right, enough's enough. And there's this vast Warsaw Pact, you know, the Soviets and allies invade in August 1968. And that's the end of the Prague Spring, which is what the liberal time was called. The Czechoslovaks absolutely hate this. There's massive popular non-violent resistance. And absolutely at the forefront of this is Emil Zatopek. So, you know, the day after the invasion, Emil Zatopek was there in Wenceslas Square, you know, addressing the crowd, saying, you know, denouncing the Russians as the gangsters of the world. Mm. And he's there the next day. He's wearing his, you know, by this time he's a colonel in the Czechoslovak army, and he's there, you know, denouncing the invaders. And he carries on doing this week after week and month after month and gets into terrible trouble. You know, by April 1969, the liberal movement's been totally crushed. The hardline communists are back in control. Anyone who supported the liberal movement is, you know, getting punished retrospectively. And Emil just basically loses everything. So he's chucked out of the army. He loses everything he's worked. He loses his run in sport. He's no longer, you know, invited to appear in schools or, you know, he's just a non-person. You know, former friends start deserting him.
Mm.
He's unable to find work because everyone's told you don't want to, you know, you can't employ Emil Zatopek if you know what's good for you.
Mm.
So eventually he has to, you know, leave Prague. You know, Dana, his wife, stays in Prague, but he has to go out. And for years, he starts working as an itinerant labourer, digging wells in remote parts of Czechoslovakia. He's just living in this little caravan with,
wow,
a few other workers, you know, sleeping in his overalls. And, you know, it's a very tough existence. It's not so much the hard work that he doesn't like, but it's just the, you know, the shame and disgrace of, you know, going from a celebrity to being a criminal. It really upsets him, and to some extent it breaks him. He'd always had been a bit of a social drinker. You know, he's a very, very social person. He, you know, was always drinking socially, and I think gradually that in these years suddenly became more than just social drinking. It became sort of like problematic drinking.
Mm.
He became very, very unhappy. He, you know, he missed his wife. He missed his friends. And by the mid-70s, in fact, by the early 70s, there was this thing where he was sort of tricked into putting his name into what seemed like a bit of a sort of retraction, or his, you know, apologizing for the liberal views in the main communist newspaper. I think this probably was mainly a trick, but at the same time, I think he'd sort of lost his self-respect a bit. That, yeah, you know, this was Emil Zatopek, the man who could endure anything, and suddenly he'd cracked under pressure. And I think that was terribly hard for him to bear. And the last years of his life, you know, I think a lot of the time he was quite unhappy, but at the same time, he still had Dana, his wife. They're still a very close marriage in many ways. He still had many friends who loved him. So, yeah, it was a sort of quieter end to his life. He was no longer the national poster boy that he had been.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, kind of summing up then, his life, how do you think he influences us today? How do you think we'll remember, or should we remember Zatopek as a, probably maybe as a runner, and then brilliant as a person as well.
I think we should remember him primarily as a person and how he, you know, what he taught us about running. Mm. Running is a way to find your better self. And, you know, yeah, there's that famous quote that, you know, an athlete cannot run with money in his pocket, but with dreams in his head and hope in his heart. Mm. I think it's, you know, modern athletes have taken on board everything that's still valid from his training methods and things like that. I think it's very easy in the modern world to forget the human side of running that he taught us so much about.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what he should be remembered for.
Yeah, fantastic. And I shouldn't keep you too much longer because it's amazing to chat about him. It's been really exciting. But I've got three more questions, which are actually right. just to you. And they're quick fire questions. Mm-hmm. And the first one is, if you could be anywhere running now, where would it be?
Right now. I think on a day like today when the sun's shining but it's not too hot, it would be hard to be the Fells of the Lake District. I think it's like the Out of the Mountains in Cumbria.
Yeah, good choice. And then second question is, can you recommend our readers something? Obviously, from our chat, we definitely recommend going and checking the book out and having a read of Emil's life. But can you recommend us anything else?
What, like anything at all? I mean, book-wise.
Yeah, we should try.
Yeah, book like experience. I don't know. A good book, if you haven't read it, is The Rise of the Ultra Runners by Ed Herron and Finn.
Yeah.
Experience. Well, I don't want this going out, but every year in Kopřivnica, which is Emil Zatopek's birthplace in what's now Czech Republic near Ostrava, they have a race in his memory. And it's a sort of just over half marathon distance. It's the friendliest road race. It goes over a mountain as well. It's got the best atmosphere of any race. And if you're a Zatopek enthusiast, I think it's always on the nearest Saturday to his birthday.
Yeah.
Which, his birthday is the 19th of September. I think this year it's the 21st.
Which is this episode will go out on the 18th. So if people are listening around when it comes out, then it's basically now his birthday. Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Well, okay, if you've got time, go out there and do it. If not, do it next year. Yeah. And you might even see Daniel there as well.
Perfect. And the final question, perhaps we've already kind of answered this, but in your opinion, what's been the greatest endurance running performance of all time?
Yeah, it's, again, I think, yeah, I mean, it's tempting to choose one of the, you know, the great fell running achievements, like, you know, Nicky Spinks' double Bob Graham round in 2016. Yeah. But I think it's got to be Emil's triple gold, triple endurance gold in Helsinki. It's never been matched, never will be matched. It wasn't just an achievement for him. It was somehow an achievement that, you know, helped sports enthusiasts of all nations to celebrate their common humanity.
Yeah.
You know, if that's not greatness, I don't know what it is.
Fantastic. Great choice. Perfect. Well, thanks a lot for chatting, Richard, and good luck with you said you're slightly, we were speaking off air at the beginning, you said you're injured at the moment, but you're coming back.
That's right, very gently, yeah. I want to keep running as long as possible. My next ambition is to keep running till I'm 100. So.
Roll on the years, good stuff. Well, lovely to chat, okay. And thanks very much.
So nice interview there, Richard. I just
sound. You're making all sorts of sounds down there.
As in my face. I slapped my face. I do that one again.
It's like when they say take one, you slap me. Like, take two, and they go shoot one. Why's your cheek red? Oh, I need to get good sound effect.
Jonathan, I think you should leave this in, and listeners behind the curtain, I just made a clap to start the recording, and I just slapped my own face. So, yeah, we'll go with it anyway. But I was going to say, nice interview there. Nice chatting about Zatopek. What an amazing man. He loved a beer. He was a crazy every runner, but he was a runner we all love. Yeah, so that was great. So we got a review, Jermaine. They're still coming in every now and again. I'll read it out to you. Hang on, let me just get my phone up. Here it goes.
People still love us.
People still love us. Yeah, we still get a few. If you haven't given us a review, we love them. Anywhere you get your podcasts, please do. This one here is, I'll read it out right now. Here we go. It is from Lucy Edwards, and she's doing it via Apple Podcasts. She says, thanks to Sean and Jermaine for their reliably entertaining running banter with top quality interviews. 5 stars. And it's also awesome. title was called Great Fun. So, Lucy, I'm glad you think it's great fun. We think it's great fun too. We'll keep doing it, which is nice. Indeed. Any reviews you can send us, brilliant. I think I mentioned the other day, Mark Sue gave us a little donation. You can do that on letsgetrunning.co.uk /podcast. There's a little button there. If you fancy giving me and Jermaine a little espresso, you can do that. Donate to us. It helps us keep the show going. And it is it's nice. You've listened to this so many years. Why not give us a little pat on the back? Go ahead, do that. What's your plans? Well, I'm running up a mountain, Jermaine. What are you going to be doing next week?
I'm on holiday from work, but I'm not going on holiday. But yeah. More importantly, football season started. So I've missed all the pre-season games.
Yeah.
So I'm just going straight into the league game on Sunday.
Perfect. So, where are you going to be playing? Left back in the changing room.
I'm guessing linesman to warm up as for first half. And then we'll see how it goes.
See how it goes. If any long-term listeners will remember last year, at the end of the season, one of Jermaine's teammates slapped another teammate in the middle of a game. So let's hope something like that happens.
Well, that guy got injured. He ruptured his Achilles, so he's out for the rest of the season.
Ah, geez. But at least there'd be no slapping. At least there'd be no hijinks. Well, good luck, Jermaine. We'll both hopefully you'll score. I'll come in the top four. It'll be good.
But you need, more importantly, you need this to get selected.
Yeah. Okay. I love you, British Athletics. I'll do anything for you. Hey. Just give me a chance. Yeah. Right. I'm going to go for a little jog and survey the scene. But we'll speak next week.
All right. Cool. See ya.
Bye.